Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday afternoon, 1st September 1982. Venerable sirs and venerable lady, in yesterday's talk, I said that essentially we are transcendence embodied. The body is the temple in which Shiva is the dweller. And at the end of the talk, I quoted the Buddha statement, "In this very body, with its perceptions and thoughts, is all the world, its origin, and the making of the world to end, that is, bringing the world to an end, likewise the way to make an end of the world." Sounds rather fierce, but one has to understand exactly what it means. The world implies all our ordinary psychical processes, all our dukkha, our impurities, and so on and so on. They are all wrapped up with the existential being, the psychophysical organism. And so what the Buddha is really saying is to bring all the impurity and the sorrow and the misery consequent upon it to an end. And that is the way to it. Now, as and when we begin to have a wider view of things and of ourselves, we find that because we are completely interrelated and interactive with all mankind, in fact with the whole world, the entire universe, science knows that nowadays, therefore the body, what we call our own body, can be extended in mind and consciousness to include everything else, the whole universe. The whole universe is the body. It is the body of transcendence itself. Now, look at that body with the third eye, by which I mean your vision when you are in samadhi's culminating states, when you are in some of the profounder and deepest states in meditation, the truly meditative state. You will see the dharmakaya, the body of law, of eternal order, which is the highest virtue. Eternal order is the highest virtue. Samadhi, of course, you understand, it means the meditative process by which you realize that ultimate in consciousness, in clear consciousness, which is the real destiny of man as such. Only the few people who are alive realize it. But that is what the whole process of evolution and our efforts to live the religious life are directing us to. And that is the dharmakaya, the body of law, of eternal order. This eternal order was, as far as the Indo-European race is concerned, was first presented in the Rig Veda under the term Ritta. Ritta is a wonderful thing altogether, and it is so deep, so profound, that it is not easily describable. There are, as far as I'm aware, only 4 verses in the whole of the Rig Veda, and it has 1,087 hymns, remember. Only 4 verses which deal specifically with Ritta as such. But it is a very significant fact that all the great gods of the Rig Veda And remember, yesterday we talked about this, and I mentioned that the gods, angels, archangels, the Amishaspans of Zarathustrianism and so forth, are names to represent primordial archetypal energies functioning at a cosmic level. In those days, they couldn't talk in terms of energies at work and this, that and the other, as we talk of it today, because of our development in science and mathematics and so on. So, whenever someone became truly sensitive and was able to respond to these different archetypal energies, forms of energy, he gave them a name. And so that is what they represent. And they are all called the sons of Ritta, the sons of eternal order. It's the most significant thing, emphasizing the harmony of the cosmos. And of course, in those days, they were unaware of the fact that galaxies collide and supernovas come into being and so forth. But to them, it was all a case of order. Because in mind and consciousness, when you are advanced and developed to that state, you are able to take in everything. If you like to put it in a sort of theistic terms, one could say, God made the universe. All right. But look at the universe. What sort of a universe is it? There are lots of trouble, lots of clashing, discord, what we would call discord and disharmony. But if and when, through living the religious life and reaching its culminating point, we expand our vision and our capacity to accept the totality, which is extremely difficult. When we can accept the totality, we don't want to chuck anything out of the universe. We accept it. It is there. Look at our own body. There are things that happen inside our own body which are sometimes troublesome, painful, and so forth. Well, we don't take our liver, our kidney, our heart and chuck it out. If you did, you'll never throw out anything else. Now, this total body, which you can compass in mind and consciousness, experience this body through purified and perfected senses, free of all grasping or wishing at this, that or the other was otherwise. You will enjoy the Sambhogakaya, the body of bliss. This capacity to accept the totality means that you can realize bliss, inner peace. Invoke this body, the total body, which is the transcendent totality, to work upon and by means of your own body, that is your existential body, existential being. This is the work of the Savior, the Teacher, the Nirmanakaya, the instrument of salvation transforming the world. After all this exaltation of the body, you will naturally ask, how is it that in the majority of bodies, their divine potential never comes to fulfillment? That these bodies are evil, and they do evil deeds throughout their lives, and are the producers and perpetuators of misery and suffering. To see into this, let us consider as briefly as possible the evolution of the human species. About 400 million years ago, animals with backbones, the vertebrates, appeared on the land. They were the first amphibians. They were both water and land dwellers. Basically, air-breathing fish beginning to modify their fins into primitive legs. About 55 million years later appeared the reptiles, succeeded by mammals who ceased to lay eggs like their predecessors and instead gave birth to live young, a far more efficient mode of reproduction and one which made for much better care of their offspring than the reptiles. Intelligent behavior began to evolve with the mammals. The main subgroup of the mammals came on the scene about 65 million years ago. They were the primates with relatively large brains, well-developed eyes, and stereoscopic vision. Gradually, these primates diversified into four main subdivisions: the prosimians, the monkeys, the apes, and man, the fourth and final one, now fully committed to a ground-living existence. The prosimians live almost entirely up amongst the trees, and showing certain unique adaptations of his own. Now, adaptation is the key to evolution. You know how the dinosaurs flourished for about 150 million years, and then when they could no longer adapt to changes in the environment, they perished. They had a pretty long innings, 150 million years. Now, in our case, complete relationship, devoid of attachment, aversion, and detachment is essential for human adaptation to environment. The human species will, by its own action, if it doesn't do that, the human species, by its own action, will go the way of the dinosaurs. Out of the first hominids, that is the fourth subdivision of the primates, out of the first hominids of the Oligocene period, geological period, about 25 million years ago, evolved Ramapithecus, 10 to 12 million years ago in India and Africa, in the late Miocene period. Australopithecus and Homo erectus, erect man, about 7 to 2.5 million years ago in the Pliocene period. Homo erectus lived in China also. In the Pleistocene period, 2.5 million to 30,000 years ago, we have Homo sapiens. We are very kind to ourselves, calling ourselves Homo sapiens, when the fact is that we are more or less Homo stultus yet, as a human race. Rhodesia man, Neanderthal man, and Solo man, as he is called. After that, in the Holocene period, come Cro-Magnon man, and a remarkable group called the Aurignacians, and from them, modern human races. Now, our present-day brain structure, bears the evidence of this long descent from the primates, the evidence of the reptilian, mammalian, and the modern stages of its evolution, and this is represented in the brain from the inside outwards. Deep inside is the oldest part of the brain. the brain stem, which conducts the basic biological functions, including heartbeat and respiration. Capping the brain stem is what is usually called the R complex, R hyphen complex, the reptilian complex. The seat of aggression, ritual, territoriality, and social hierarchy evolved hundreds of millions of years ago in the reptiles, and we inherit that reptilian aspect of the development of the brain. I think Arthur Koestler particularly called it the crocodile brain in us. Surrounding it is the limbic system or mammalian brain, evolved tens of millions of years ago in mammals, not yet primates. This mammalian brain in us is a major source of our moods and emotions, of concern and care for the young. Finally, we have the development of the cerebral cortex, evolved some millions of years ago in our primate ancestors. The cerebral cortex, which comprises approximately two-thirds of the total mass of the brain, is the realm, is the seat of intuition and insight, and critical analysis, ideas, inspirations, reading, writing, music, mathematics, and so on. The cerebral cortex is responsible for that. It regulates our conscious lives. It is the seat of our humanity. It is the source of our civilization. That is, speaking materially. Now, this cerebral cortex functions in uneasy truce with the mammalian and the reptilian brain. Now, you see, whenever the reptilian brain is overpowerful, it wins out against the mammalian as well as the cerebral cortex, and that is why you get evil bodies, evil beings. It is too powerful for the rational mind or the human part of the truly human part of us to win out against this tremendous impulse coming from the reptiles. I think Koestler was very sound in calling it our crocodile brain. In the scriptures and religious teachings of the past, and in our own day also, the word mind has been constantly used in connection with our thoughts and feelings, ideas, perceptions, intuitions, and deep insights, all of which are classed as mental. The Greeks introduced the word psyche, and our English terms, psyche and psychical, have come into increasingly frequent use in this century. The Buddhist term nama rupa, commonly translated as mind and body, to denote the existential, mutable, and mortal human being, is also regarded as mentality, materiality. And the Visuddhimagga makes very, very good use of this term, mentality, materiality, for nama rupa. It's Nyanamoli's translation. This is much to be approved, for it gives us the sense of nama rupa, both as the one universe and also as each of the countless many in which in their integration constitute the one. Mind in its perfection and actuality is shunya, void. The pellucid void, not made opaque by obstructive particulars. In Huang Po's teaching, the terms Buddha, Absolute, and the One Mind are synonymous. You will find this in John Blofeld's introduction to his translation, The Zen Teaching of Huang Po, page 16 of the introduction. Since we today live in a scientific age in which the key word is energy, we may, just may, speak of mind as that archetypal expression, the formative power of primordial, undifferentiated creative energy, which releases cosmos within and out of chaos. You may wonder why I say within and out of chaos. Chaos, in its original meaning, is a state of vibrant quiescence. It is only later on that the meaning of disorder came into being. The state of the origin, so to say, was in this state of vibrant quiescence. Vibrant because it was alive. And the entire universe is alive. Science today knows, particularly through the researchers of Dr. Chu and Dr. Kapra and his colleagues, and their colleagues, that every single subatomic particle is such a bad word, but we have to invent a new word for it now. Subatomic particle throws out a virtual particle and reabsorbs it at an extraordinary speed, 10 to the power 23 times per second. It would take us the whole lifetime of our planet to count that number. But these things can be calculated as a result of experimental research. And they are more or less reliable. You can add or subtract two or three noughts in modern science, just as the ancient Hindus, as regards the age of the universe, just added and subtracted half a dozen noughts as they pleased to make it look grand or to make it look a little more agreeable, considering the size of our own egos. So, within this state of vibrant quiescence, this first thrill of action, the primordial karma, the creative action at work, released the cosmos. This not only in the material sense, but also in a much deeper sense. There are orders of creation of which science and the material-minded person knows nothing about. The devotee, the religious believer may have some ideas about it, but we can only have ideas about it. It's too much beyond human capacity, at least certainly my capacity. So that's why I say releases cosmos within and out of chaos. Chaos is the substance, the underlying substance, immaterial substance, remember. This universal mind energy interacting with matter, and in our case with the material body, gives rise to psyche, which is special to each and every person. Mind is universal, it is characterless, it is nondescript. It belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal, not to our context of finitude, temporality, and mortality. That, to me, is mind in its fullness. And as a matter of fact, I derived that from this statement in connection with Huang Po, that pure mind, Buddha, and absolute are synonymous terms. psyche is rooted in the brain and nerves and the ductless glands and bloodstream, which are the main determining factors of all one's psychical processes and life. Mind is utterly pure and perfect. Psyche is tainted. It is psyche which suffers from what in Buddhist terminology is called the defilements of the mind. I would rather put it this way: the mind has no defilements at all. Pure mind has no defilements at all. It is psyche which is special to each and every one of us, and which we can legitimately refer to as my psyche. I would never say my mind. I have no mind as yet as such, and I never will have. Mind will have me as and when the psyche is utterly purified. I think if you sort of rest, brood over this when you have the opportunity, you will find it very helpful to understand so many things. Instead of saying impure mind and pure mind and differentiating them like that, the psyche. It's the psyche which is the defiled thing. Because of the influence of the material body, the reptilian brain, the mammalian brain, they are all at work, you see, and the cortex, and they are in conflict. Psyche is tainted by all the defilements from which we have to free ourselves. I should never say purify the mind, but purify the psyche, because our psychical processes are intimately bound up with and influenced by our animal heritage. As and when the psyche is utterly purified, emptied, and the existential being is reduced to its nothingness, and further, the body also is entirely clean, then the main purpose of our existence is wholly fulfilled. The Buddha was a supreme healer of the psyche and paripasyu of the body, because what we loosely call body is actually a psychophysical organism, nama rupa. And you cannot separate the psychical element or aspect from the material aspect. You cannot separate the nama from the rupa. They are a one. That is why I often say that every single cell in our body, as we call the organism, is derived from our ancestors. And if our ancestors were members of this religion or that religion, the body, the cells of the body themselves are Christian or Buddhist or Hindu or whatever it is. Now, if one really sees into this, one will appreciate and understand how we can produce a harmonious relationship between what we inherit psychically and when we turn to something else which gives us more satisfaction, and we'll understand why we voluntarily convert ourselves into another religion. Actually, as I see it, I may be quite wrong. I don't see any reason why one should turn to another religion. You see, take the best out of it, and if you can really penetrate into the deeps of your own religion, you will find it all there. Look at the Epistle of James, for example, in the New Testament. The sealers are all there. And that is only one example, and so forth. But, of course, naturally, each constitution being a unique constitution, that that environment in which we are born may not be the most suitable one, and what we have inherited from it. So it is perfectly legitimate to turn to something else. Out of infinite compassion and wisdom, the Buddha showed a way, the way of complete purification. And that way, the Dhamma, is lovely in the beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely in the end. It's a wonderful way of putting it. He emphasized the beauty of the whole thing. And he emphasized the beauty with a deep understanding of what he inherited from his predecessors, the idea of Ritta, this eternal order, this eternal law at work. And this is so wonderful. If all children could be in their upbringing and in their ordinary education could be helped to see that this cooperation with the eternal law, which prevails throughout the universe, our planet today would be very free from so much evil and horror that exists at present. Don't call this way a way of attainment or achievement. That word attainment comes in too much. One attains this, one attains that. But attainment is the result of grasping. The perfect thing emerges beautifully, simply. Here is a tray. Here are the buds. Spring, summer, and it all emerges so beautifully just by itself, naturally, spontaneously. This is the loveliness of the universe. This is joy. And the sense perceptions, whatever sense perceptions experience that kind of joy, that pleasure is true pleasure, healthy pleasure. It's not something which is destructive or harmful or obstructive to the religious life. Attainment and achievement, etc., are all egotistical, vain glorifications of selfness. This existential being, which calls itself I, is merely a pimple on the nose of transcendence. When I have disappeared, the face of transcendence is absolute beauty, the one and only original face. It's no good inquiring what is your original face. You, the separate individual as such, the existential being, has no original face. The only original face is the face of transcendence itself, which is absolute beauty, absolute harmonious functioning of eternal law. The way of the Buddha, the Brahmacharya, is the living of the holy life, the godly life, if you like to use that term. It is the way of sila, samadhi, panya, virtue, meditation, or contemplative prayer, or communion, I would like to say, panya, insight. The way of virtue, communion, unerring insight into truth. These three are not to be taken as three separate tasks. Life is a movement in wholeness. Sila, samadhi, panya are a constantly interdependent, interacting, and influencing each other, whole. And they function and work together constantly, and they are dependent upon each other. You cannot say, I will cultivate sila this year, samadhi the next year, and cap it with panya the third year. If you approach it that way, you will certainly receive your certificate of stupidity at the end of the third year and wear a dunce cap, not a mortarboard. Sila, morality, is an indispensable foundation for living, whether it be the domestic life, the business life, the holy life, the secular life or the religious life. I have qualified our living process dualistically and also in triple terms, because the mass of people does regard daily living fragmentarily. Dividing things up and categorizing them, pigeonholing them, is so ingrained in us that it is sometimes helpful to use the different terms as such. But actually it is all one. This is the world's profound error, fragmenting everything. And sin. The fundamental meaning of the word sin is whatsoever spoils or hurts the unity of the universe. That is the fundamental meaning of sin. The holy life, the brahmacharya, is quite simply living our whole life religiously. Essentially, this means living our whole life not as unto ourselves, as isolated separate units, but as unto the one and only whole, holy unit, the one total reality. Whilst in a limited sense it is true that we start with morality, in fullness we start, proceed and persevere with all three simultaneously, sila, samadhi, panya. The whole thing, then you've got the wholeness of it, and you get the true livingness of it all. Today, as in past ages, the world's moral backbone is a broken one. Its brain is diseased. Its whole body is poisoned. As soon as we are able to live a little virtuously, that is harmlessly, honestly, refraining from sense indulgence, not right use of the senses, falsehood and all intoxicants, including gross foods, the products of murder and cruelty, our ability to pay proper, full attention improves. And insight emerges. The purification of the nama rupa, the psyche body, has begun then. You all know how it starts with affluence. Affluence is the start of the breakdown and the destruction of all civilizations. Deprivation is also evil. But I think affluence is the greater evil. I feel sure that a moderate condition is the best for civilization. Neither deprived nor having too much. A decent austerity, that's the real phrase I want. A decent austerity is what we really need as human beings. By being harmless and honest, we begin to be released from anxiety and fear. Then there is security. A security not merely vaguely felt, but really experienced. Whoso can live free of all self-concern is utterly secure. Morality is a very powerful influence for such security. But shun all moral effort for the sake of desired good results, for that is a thoroughly unmoral morality. Refraining from self in sense indulgence sharpens the right use of the sense functions, most important for living sensibly and intelligently, for freedom from slavery to our pleasure drives, which are perhaps the most destructive factor in the life of mankind today, even as they were 25 centuries ago in the Buddha's day. The Buddha's fiercest denunciations, as you know, were leveled against sense pleasures. I believe we are all agreed that the Buddha was wisdom itself. Would we be wise, then, to disregard him on the question of sense pleasure? Affluence has proved itself to be the curse of all civilizations and destroyed them. Look what happened with the Roman Empire. It was a marvelous empire, and Rome's great bequest to the world is law. That is Rome's bequest. Just as Greece's bequest was beauty, is the aesthetic aspect of life. The right use of wealth, it is quite right to produce wealth, produce it, not acquire it just for oneself. The right use of wealth is impossible without the harmony of compassion and wisdom motivating its use. The senses must be rightly trained, for ultimately they are the cords of communion in the Supreme Samadhi. In that Supreme Samadhi, it's the sort of transfiguration of one's senses, if I may put it that way, which are the cords of communion with the totality. The supreme togetherness, samadhi, which begins with observation, grows into pure observation, and culminates after realizing the silence in the deathless state. This realization of silence is a very, very important thing. It comes in all the mystical disciplines and in the religious disciplines of the world. All of them have that. Why this silence? Consider. What do words represent? Nouns and verbs, they represent persons, things, and actions, and so forth. And all words belong, the spoken word or the written word belongs to the context of the finite, temporal, and mortal. Word represents a particular something, in order that we may distinguish this from the other, you see, and so forth, in our present condition and in our present environment. So words belong to the realm of the mortal. Now, as you enter the deeper states of meditation, in Buddhist teaching, it is the second jhana, where the first silence is experienced. I call it the first portal of death. It's a death of that which belongs to the finite realm. You see, that is out of your consciousness. You are alert, you are awake, mind you, as in the meditative process. In the Upanishads, you have it presented as the Jagrat stage, the waking state, the Swapna, the dreaming state, the susupti, the deep sleep state, and then finally the turiya, the transcendent state. You may wonder how on earth deep sleep and dreaming states can be can stand for alertness and awakenedness. But until the days of the Upanishads, they used those words in order that the unworthy may not attempt all sorts of things. It was in order to preserve the esotericism of the whole thing. But this dream state meditation, as it is called, is that state in which you just look into everything as it happens without trying to alter it, without condemning it, without getting attached to it, without having aversion for it. This is in your dream. Now, you know how in your dream the most extraordinary things happen. You can't You see a tiger coming at you and you can't run fast enough. You can't run at all, in fact. And so on. So this is the earlier state. They use those terms deliberately. And the sushupti, the deep slumber state, when the brain really goes to sleep, when the brain is asleep like that, then they said, the Atma goes back to its own. To its own ordinary level. But this is, again, I think, a misleading way of presenting it. In the turiya state, the fourth state, which is beautiful, which is best presented in the Mandukya Upanishad. I think that's the finest presentation in any of the religious or mystical teachings that I know of. There, transcendence embodied as you meets transcendence, the totality. And it's an extraordinary description in the Mandukya Upanishad. Read it carefully. I think in The Heart of Religion I've given the whole of it. It's a very short Upanishad, but it's very well worth studying. So, in that state, with the brain activity stopping, the ordinary intellectualist processes disappear altogether. And then it is a sense of transcendence which has come to fulfillment. You know, in the Sankhya philosophy, they talked of the subtle senses, you see, and people have all sorts of queer imaginary ideas about what subtle senses means. But I remember meeting in India a Swami who was a very remarkable man. He was a retired lawyer. And he understood these things very deeply. And he divulged to me much about in connection with this subtle senses business. And so I feel that these senses come into operation and they are the cords of communion. But the psychophysical sense activity must be purified first. Otherwise that sensitivity cannot come into operation. So now the silence means that you are well awake, alert, and you are getting free of the realm of the mortal. And as you go deeper, this silence intensifies, it deepens tremendously until you are conscious, you are clearly conscious, and this is one of the great things the Buddha pointed out, as I think no other teachers or mystics have pointed out. You are clearly conscious. He says that again and again, clearly conscious. It's very important. You are clearly conscious. Well, in what manner are you conscious when the whole of mortality has been transcended? You are conscious in the mode of immortality. Nothing begins, proceeds, dies. Nothing enters that consciousness which is a separate item. Separation, isolation is the sin, the root sin. The Catholics were quite right, but I don't think the Catholic world it knows why and how it is right. That man is born in sin. We are born with separation growing in us, the sense of separateness. So now, yes, what is pure observation? Perfect mindfulness, samasati. Our faculty of attentiveness is our instrument of salvation. Our salvation is not merely personal. It spells the salvation of humanity, simply because we are interrelated with everything and interacting with everything. So when a Buddha arises, or a Christ, or a Zarathustra, or a Krishna comes into being, his life and his influence affects the totality in even a little measure. But the totality is influenced by the individual. The activity of any one atom affects the whole universe. And the whole universe affects each atom. Look at it that way, understand that in depth, and you will have quite a different conception of the meaning of karma. I tried last year to present this. Some of you may have been present. Do you remember? Good. The personal isolated I, aham, is the word in Sanskrit and Pali, dissolves into the transcendent aham, the universal I am. Whenever the Buddha says, but I, monk, or I, he uses the word aham, I'm sure he uses the word aham, of course, obviously in the ordinary psychophysical sense, this person, but also he has the full consciousness of the totality underlying it. And that is why I think the influence of the great teachers was so universal. I mean, after all, you take the great religions of the world, just four or five or so, and how they have lived through thousands of years and affected the life of the world. This aham is the universal I am, the ehie asher ehie of Yahweh Elohim talking to Moses out of the burning bush. You find that in Exodus chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. The I am I, which has given up I, the words of Shiva, the third person of the Hindu Trinity, instructing Kumara the Kartikeya. I am the I, which has given up I. It comes in the Tejobindu Upanishad, which is ascribed, I believe, to Shankaracharya. When we are mindful, we pay attention to all the stimuli and impressions which reach us via the senses or arise in memory. This mindfulness is flabile at first when we start, because our power of attentiveness is weak. Gradually, through perseverance, the intensity of mindfulness grows and grows till it becomes a true tapas, a white-hot concentration which is all-inclusive, excluding nothing. When concentration, we are taught to concentrate on any one thing as such, but there comes the point when that concentration, reaching its true culmination, becomes all-inclusive. The one thing being related completely and entirely with the total universe, the whole universe comes into it. And as a matter of fact, the whole universe, the macrocosm, is embodied in every single microcosm. You see, once you get a flash of this, not merely a perception through intellectual activity, but you suddenly get the reality of it going through and through you with a tremendous intensity, your whole life gets transformed. Then there has to be simultaneously a coming to fruition of virtue, of sila, and an increasing of flashing insights. Here the purity of our organic life and the unselfing of our isolative self-consciousness stands us in good stead. Without the necessary purity and selflessness, the tremendous voltage of the psycho-mental activity, for now, pure mind is beginning to function through the psyche. The tremendous voltage of that psycho-mental activity could disorient the brain and nerves, even seriously damage or destroy the organism. You know, they explained the death of Vivekananda this way, that he was in a deep state of consciousness and so forth, and there was a hemorrhage, and he died. Throughout the exercise of mindfulness, be well aware of the reactions from the brain, especially in the early stages, because the brain will be constantly talking back, chattering away merrily at all the stimuli that reach it. Now, perhaps one can begin to appreciate why in the school of Pythagoras, the acousticoi, when those who first came to the school, they were the acousticoi, the listeners. They never uttered a word except to say yes or no or whatever it was when the teacher spoke to them. Otherwise, they kept their mouths shut. It would be an excellent thing if the whole world today could possibly be just start with being acousticoi. Think of the terrible damage done throughout the world with chatter. This is a very important, perhaps the most important part of sati. Because as you go deeper and deeper into the inner conditions of consciousness, the intensification of the awareness of transcendence spells a greater and a greater silence all along the line. In the Varaha Upanishad, I think, it is repeated 3 times, practice silence, practice silence, practice silence, you see. And one can only start by holding one's tongue, first and foremost. So this silence is one of the most important parts of mindfulness, for these reactions from the brain, which is the concretest expression of pure mind and also its indispensable material apparatus, will reveal all that fills the imperfect psyche, our wishes, drives, passions, follies, etc. Am I preventing? Oh dear. It's just 5:25.
It's 29.
Is it?
28.
It won't take a minute to finish. Yes, finish this. May I?
Yes.
Our wishes, drives, passions, follies, etc. In short, all our conditioning, all that shuts out the light of transcendence, of enlightenment. When our whole existential being can exercise such intense mindfulness, then indeed the fullness of pure observation is functioning. Such observation is the real samasati, the perfect mindfulness. It diagnoses our ill state, dukkha perfectly, and is itself the medicine which heals us. For such mindfulness reintegrates us into the wholeness, and we are in holy communion. Allow me to use that phrase. In samadhi then. It's the complete perfect communion. The holy life, brahmacharya, is then fully operative till death comes. Then the existential I is no more. Neither gods nor men shall see me, as the Buddha said in the Brahmajala Sutta, right at the end of the Brahmajala. Transcendence alone is infinite, eternal, immortal. The Brahma-faring under the Lord is lived for utter Nibbana without attachment, said Punna to Sariputta. First volume of the Vajina. Thank you. And do forgive me for overrunning my time. Yes.
Do you have any suggestions, any practical suggestions about how, you know, what we can do about the situation?
You mean the world situation?
The general situation. I mean, faced with the fact that when mankind, you know, acquires affluence, that we see this tendency again and again. Do you think it is purely in, you know, that we can do something about it? As part of the normal sort of teaching process, or do you think that that will be necessary for some additional evolutionary change to occur before man is able to, you know, to learn to live more wisely?
Consider, in the first place, how affluence comes into being. What is the psychological factor at play? Greed, essentially, isn't it? I want more. I want to be a millionaire. You remember on Saturday, was it, or Sunday, I mentioned I gave the example of that dear man who came to our groups at my house, you see, and he thought that he was going to learn from me some yoga or some mental or how to develop some mental powers which would enable him to make £1,000,000, and he wanted to do all that quite quickly. I asked him, what do you want £1,000,000 for? I can benefit humanity, do wonderful things for mankind with £1,000,000. So I'm afraid I had to disillusion him. After the seventh meeting, he just didn't come anymore. And I hope he never made any £1,000,000. There we are, you see. Now greed lies at the back of that. And that greed is associated with all sorts of ideas of I can be happy, I can be powerful, I can do this, I can do the other, all centering around this self-oriented, separative, isolative I. You see, I am I. And it is this which brings about all the trouble. Look at the extraordinary amount of misery that the majority of very rich people experience. Wife runs away with somebody, the son is had up for or something. And look at the case of that American girl.
Barbara Hutter, Woolworths.
No. I'm not thinking of that. Who was? Who?
She was kidnapped.
Pat Hearst. That's it. Look at that case, for instance. I mean, what tragedy. How the parents must have suffered, whatever were their views or anything maybe. But I mean, a thing like that scars one's life. Absolutely scars it. So, the practical solution lies with each one of us individually. Each and every one of us. It's a peculiar tendency in us, in our state of ignorance, to want to change the world. But what do I want to change the world into? Some silly little picture which I have in my own little mind. Is there any warrant that the picture I have in my mind, and my mind is my brain is an imperfect thing? I am subhuman still. All right. Is there any warrant that that picture is really the right sort of is it a true vision? One must have an understanding, a vision of the nature of man, his relationship to the environment, to the whole world, the whole universe, and thereby see what is the purpose of his existence here. And when one does get something like a true vision of that purpose, then one can direct all one's energies towards helping that purpose. One of the dangerous things to avoid, even in that good situation, is to predetermine, to make a picture of that purpose and what you are working for. Life proceeds naturally and spontaneously. It doesn't have preconceptions of an ought to be, because life itself is something transcendent to us, you see. And all our pictures are false pictures. I remember how I went through things like this right from my childhood onwards, because I was naturally interested in matters religious and deep. I was a queer fish, to tell you the truth. You see, I stopped playing all games at school well before I was 12. By the time I was about 10, after that I never played games. I used to come home immediately after school, lie on my bed, and read Plato and Aristotle and philosophy and all sorts of things like that. You see. In that state, I had all sorts of pictures of what ought to be done, what the world should be like that. As I grew up, it gradually went. But, you know, these things have a considerable devastating effect upon the organism. I paid the price, not altogether happily, for it all. That is why I haven't got a sort of a constitution like a horse, which I could have had, considering my descent. My father and mother were both very strong and all that. Not me.
Do we usually call them ideals? Where ideals are these things that we picture?
Yes, you see, but ideals are the... An ideal is a culmination of an idea or a group of ideas. Then you have an ideal, but it's a fixation.
Yes, it's an idol, really.
It's an idol, really. It's a fixed picture, and it's the fixation which is the illness. It's like having a, what is it called, a tumor. It's a psychical tumor. So one has to be free of all that. One has to withhold imposing oneself, being self-obtrusive. I think in the Mahavagga, the Buddha, during that third period of 7 days in meditation, when he finishes and he talks about the freedom of the mind and so forth, and he says, he who has reached to the end of knowledge and is not self-obtrusive, he verily may speak the Brahma word. I'm sorry, I can't quite remember the thing exactly, but
I think a partial answer to Mr. Ickes' question. I read Malcolm Muggeridge's account of his meeting with Mother Teresa, and he asked her, wasn't her work such a small thing in the context of India's problems? And she said that she came not to heal a nation, but an individual. She wanted to give love to a person, not to an ideal of a nation. And that's where it began, between two individuals.
Now there was true intelligence to realize that. Yes?
Do you have any sort of knowledge or information of what kind of events, say, or would bring about the evolution of the human brain? I mean, your description of the brain,
yes,
building up from one section to another, and that we've now reached this stage.
Yes.
I would think that it, before we become affected, it's going to have to evolve.
Yes. You see, until the advent of the primates, everything happened by natural adaptation to the environment all the time, you see. And the impressions were made on the brain, which made the brain undergo this, that and the other change accordingly. And then after that, when the hominids really came on the scene, they were capable of looking within, and they were capable of memory, which was not just the memory which is ingrained in the cells of the body or the cells of the brain and so forth. You see, the whole body has its own memory working. Take a pianist. The finger memory is the first stage, where you memorize a piece quickly, we say, but it is in your fingers. It's a finger memory, belonging to your sense of touch. If you stumble somewhere, you have to go to the beginning and start again. You can't get it back. But the true memory comes when, in addition to perfect finger memory, your brain knows the structure of the piece. Really knows the structure of the thing, you see. Now, all this has developed through the 3-4 million years or whatever it is since man came on the globe. And the mammalian aspect has been the one which has led to compassion and so forth. The care for the young was the first step forward. We can now deliberately change things. We don't have to wait for nature to go on. Now the responsibility rests with man himself. The responsibility for purifying his psyche, developing his intellectual powers, his powers to perceive and understand, all that is his particular work. Nature has handed over to man. But the influence of the sense functions is so strong, and particularly the pleasure drive. Well, that is quite understandable, because the body has an ingrained pleasure-pain mechanism. What is painful, the body will withdraw from it because it is dangerous for its life. What is pleasurable, the body will accept. But the person, the psychophysical person as such, in his unregenerate state, wants more and more of the pleasure. He gets an attachment for it, just as he has an aversion. Aversion arises through what is painful. You see? But the pleasure-pain mechanism is absolutely essential for the body to move about and do things and so forth. But the psychical counterpart which arises, attachment through the pleasure, aversion through the pain. This is the thing that we have to work upon.
But does the actual work that we do in this, you know, in this process, have an effect upon the brain cells, and, you know, the
I should think it does.
Is it, do you think, evolving?
I should think it does. You see, the brain itself changes as one really grows towards the true human fulfillment. Look at the meaning of the word human from its root, man. The dictionaries will give you just a partial meaning. The root man, they say, is to think. You see? What do we mean by thinking? Talking silently. That is all. Essentially. Some people say, oh no, I get a series of pictures. I think in pictures. All right. You think in pictures. The pictures pass through your brain. You see? All right. How does the brain recognize the pictures? And how are you able to convey those pictures to another person? Excepting through words. The symbolical sounds which convey all objects, things, persons, and so on. You see? So our thinking is just a stream of words. Essentially it's that. But this thinking is not creative. It can be a stimulus, a powerful stimulus, and sometimes a very powerful stimulus to a course of action, true. But thinking in the real sense is associated with creation, not with procreation. You can think out a poem, you can think out a sonata or song or whatever it is, you see, or a sculpture or something. This is the result of is confined to the realm of the finite and the temporal and so forth. But the real key to understanding this comes in the Hermetic writings, Hermes Trismegistus' teaching, you see, where it is said, God is called All Father Mind. It's very significant, especially considering its relation to Buddhism. All Father Mind. The thought in the mind of God was the creative word. This is the Logos, you see. And it is that creative word which brought forth the manifested world. But therefore, since God obviously hasn't got a brain like we have, you see, we being the inferior, mind you, not that God is brainless. God is all mind, all father mind, as the Trismegistic writings put it. Created man in his own living likeness, co-equal to him, and fell in love with him because he was so beautiful. But that was this creative thought which acting on matter ultimately produced man. Man as we understand man. But this is man with a capital M, capital A, capital N. The divine concept, man. Of course, all this is what has come down to us through centuries and centuries, but it may not be true. One must always keep one's mind open, completely open. And so, the meaning of the word human. Man means really to create, just as the word karma means to create. Comes from kri. And the dictionary is again just, the dictionary for man says to think, to muse, and all that sort of stuff, you see. And the word kri they define as to do or to make. You see, this is where Genesis, I think, is wrongly translated, first chapter, verse 25 and 26. And God said, let us make man in our image. I put it this way, and God, Elohim, it's best to use the original words, not say the English word God, and Elohim minded. And minded, let us create man in our own living likeness. This is a very different thing from God said. What language did he say it in?
In English.
Oh, of course. Of course. Well, in this country, God is always an Englishman.
Rita.
Rita.
Is it any connection with the Amrita?
No, Amrita is deathlessness. That is related to Mrityu, which is death. And Amrityu is immortality, you see.
So they call it the drink of immortality.
The nectar of immortality. The meaning of the word human, you must remember this is the, it is the creative aspect, and it is it has the prefix hu. The prefix hu or su, su, in Pali it is su. The Buddha is called Sugata, he who has gone happily, you see. And if you talk of happiness in connection with divinity, in connection, which means in the context of transcendence, one uses a word like bliss, not joy or pleasure or anything, or happiness as we know it, but this ananda, which I was talking of yesterday, you remember? Ananda, this bliss. Creation is a blissful thing altogether. And creation is quite different from what we commonly call creation. We say a composer creates music, a poet creates poetry. These are not creations, these are procreations. They are cultural procreations because they are all true to type and have a relationship with a predecessor previous state out of which this new thing is formed. Look at the way, for instance, the sonata form and the symphonic form emerged gradually. Look at what were called symphonies in the days before Bach, and then even in the days of John Sebastian Bach. And then later on, Haydn, working upon that, took it so many stages further, and Mozart and Beethoven sort of pinnacled it with his particular form. And listen to modern symphonies. Most of them are cacophony.
Would you say the one was created that Mozart wrote?
took him many hours, and he dreamt it in a few seconds of time.
As far as I know, about 65 years ago, when I first sort of got enamored of Western music, and I had books about the lives of the composers and so on, and one chapter was the life of Mozart, and he was asked, as far as I remember in this book, he was asked by a friend, how do you hear your inspiration, how does your inspiration come to you? And Mozart said, I hear it first as one tremendous chord. You see, I hear it as a chord, and all these notes and chords which make the score of a symphony follow out of that, emerge out of that, you see. So now the word human really means blissful creator. That is our divine potential, blissful creation. And creation is not procreation, either biological or cultural. Creation is the release of something utterly new, not out of anything. It's the main root and the main trunk itself, not the other, these branches, which are just limited productions compared with the main thing, you see. It's not easy to describe all this, but brood over it. Let the brain be quiet. And when the psyche is free of turmoil, you will experience these things. So that's why I say we are subhuman, still sub in the sense of not yet quite grown up as a human species. The culmination, of course, is the perfected Holy One. So to tackle the world situation, we have to work towards that for ourselves, the complete purification of the psyche and so forth. You see, every one of us radiates an influence. There is a group of people who are having a harmonious meeting, and then that fellow Bloggs comes in, and he's out of tune with all these people, and the whole atmosphere changes. He radiates that disturbing influence out of his psyche. So we have to live and grow in such a way that we radiate a beneficial influence all the time. But we can't picture it beforehand. We can't preconceive it. We mustn't try to preconceive this harmonious influence and so forth. Just let be. See that we don't do anything wrong. That's where the Buddha's psychological perception was so marvelous. It is perfect psychology to talk in terms which we know. Hatred ceases not by hatred. Hatred ceases by non-hatred. So many translators say by love. That's a mistake. We don't know what love is. The perfected Holy One really knows love. And you see, when you really know something like that, you're truly conscious of it. That consciousness has come to actual manifestation concretely. This is something which psychologists, as far as I'm aware, just don't know at all.